Hi, I'm Dave Custy, and welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. In this broadcast, we are discussing integrating technology in live legitimate theater. My guest today is Robert Matney. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Robert.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me on.
Robert Matney was born in Dallas, Texas. He's a web developer, actor, theater director. He's currently living in Austin, Texas. Robert is the founding member of Breaking String Theater and the technology designer at the Hidden Room Theater. He spoke at the SXSW, South by Southwest Interactive 2011, with the Hidden Room and Look Left, Look Right, about their work on Skype Theater and linking actors and audience using technology. Robert Matney graduated from the University of Texas in 1998 with a degree in philosophy. So now that you've got a little Reader's Digest version of your life, how about adding a little bit to it?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I live in Austin, Texas, with my partner Liz and our dog Viola. I'm the director of technology for Hidden Room Theater, and I serve on the board of Austin Shakespeare. I am a web developer, stage actor, director, and producer, and most relevantly for this chat, a technology designer for the theater. In addition to 2011, I also was featured at 2012 and 2013 South by Southwest Interactive Conference, both of which were a real pleasure and joy to be a part of. I also helped to run a web development shop called Polycot Associates that creates websites as well as web and mobile apps.
So how did you get interested? I mean, you have a web developer background and technology background, but how did you get interested into integrating technology into theater?
Well, for me, it was all about integrating the two parts of my life. I spend half of my time around the stage and the other half in front of a computer, making apps and websites for different kinds of organizations. I guess it's really just to say that I spend all of my time thinking about how to effectively tell a story that produces a visceral response and a shared experience. And so naturally, my desire turned to figuring out what are the real ways to combine it. In ways, how do we make online participation more theatrical? And how do we take advantage of the virtues of ones and zeros in a theatrical context? And so I work towards each other in both domains and sometimes get to really combine them.
Tell me about some of the projects that you have completed already that integrate technology and theater.
Sure. So the first piece that really had a focus on it was a piece called You Wouldn't Know Her, She Lives in London. At least that was its name in Austin. And in London, it was called You Wouldn't Know Him, He Lives in Texas. This was a piece where the cast was split out across two geographic locations, London and Austin. They were connected by audio and video stream, so mutual audio and video stream. And with cast on both sides, there was also live audience on both sides. And we did a really granular video pickup and a really granular mic pickup so that, you know, if someone in Austin opened their candy wrapper, they could annoy someone in London very effectively. And the way we lined up the video of it was such that it created a straight line, at least metaphorically, where there was, if you imagine the audience on one end and then the Austin audience on one end, Austin actors next, then London actors, then London audience. And so from one vantage point, everyone could see everyone. So there was shared visibility for a kind of, you know, coherent visual and aural space. The play was then transacted across that connection. And we then picked up those two audio-video streams, made them appear as if they were looking at each other, and then embedded them into a website and streamed that so that you could then watch online as well. And in all three visual spaces here, and by that I mean in the plasma display in London, the projector space in Austin, and then in the web space online, we also included a text stream behind a Twitter hashtag that was constantly updating. And we encouraged our audiences to interact with the characters, and we trained the actors on responding in real time to that feedback that was coming in. So that what you had was really a shared mutual interactive experience through text, audio, and video. So that was the first piece that we did. And
let me ask you something just about that.
Absolutely.
On my mind. Everybody could see everybody else, right, on the video? What about the play itself? They interact, people in London and Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a single play happening at one time.
And so the
actors were very much acting against each other. They were acting against each other and with each other locally and also disparately.
So say the actors in London were looking at a screen of the actors in Austin.
That's right. In London, we had a large plasma display. In Austin, we had a really high definition projector. And it was all lined up in such a way that while interacting with the actors on one side, they were also interacting with the remote actors.
The other question I had was about live interaction during the play.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Go into a little more detail about that.
Yeah, sure. So the play was a hybrid of scripted and improvisational. And the play was scripted such that there were basically exit ramps and entrance ramps. So there were points where the scripted narrative led to a kind of intentional off-scripting that then allowed for the actors to interact with the text and the feedback that was coming in from their various audiences, both local and remote. And it then had entrance ramps to get back on. So we worked with the actors to hear the cues from each other, know the time when it was right to scripted go off of script, and then how to cue each other that it was time to get back onto the script. So though it wasn't visible to the audience, there was a kind of natural interplay. So the whole thing actually felt quite improvisational, even though the lion's share of it was scripted and scripted by the director, Beth Burns.
How did the actors take to it?
Yeah, you know, you get right to what for me was the most exciting thing about it, which is I envision that as film was emerging as an art form, that there was a period, and I feel like see this in early film, where the technique for the art had to be unpacked from the technology itself. So acting for the stage doesn't really work for the camera, but what is it that's exactly different? Well, initially they wouldn't have known. They would have gone by their patterns, which is to act for the stage. But over time, it would have been clear that there are adjustments and techniques that will serve you better on camera than they will on stage, and those emerge. Similarly, we discovered a surprisingly complex set of techniques to be unpacked for acting for the compressed data stream. And that gets to a lot of interesting intricacies. So if I could, let me give an example, because
Please.
It's one of the most interesting parts of the whole process. And then I'll answer your question about how they took to it, which will be briefer. In order to keep video streams, mutual video streams, looking natural and sounding natural, there's an awful lot of data compression going on behind the scenes. Obviously, you can't grab full resolution HD, send it in both directions, and have it work at a half globe distance without running into some very serious lag time. So tools like Skype and other tools run a whole cocktail of compression maneuvers in order to minimize the data so that what they're sending can keep up, frankly. So one of the things that Skype does, and others, one of the compression maneuvers is to drop frames that aren't relevant or parts of frames that aren't relevant. So if your face is staying, your head is staying still, it won't take a new frame of your head. If your eyes are moving, however, it will take a new subframe of your eyes. So you'll have new eyes and old heads, right? But it's, in the meanwhile, dropping an extraordinary quantity of data left and right.
But it knows how to do that then. I mean, that's an obvious question.
It knows how to do it, and it does it very well.
I'm not very
And on the fly. One of the things we discovered is that if you get still, you are producing less data and your lag time will diminish. If you have a dynamic emotional moment that requires movement, then you're going to produce more visual data. It's less compressible, and therefore it's going to build your lag time. So there is a way of dynamically treating, almost like a hydraulic or a plumbing system, how much you have to play with, and slowing down and getting more still when you need to earn more time back. And then when you can spend it, you can spend it with dynamic physical movement. There are similar algorithms in terms of vocal patterns the less fricative, the more monotone you are, the more compressible that data is. The more dynamic your voice is, the more up and down you go, and the more, fricative that sound is, the less compressible it is, and so the more data you spend. So you get to a kind of data bank account mindset where you have something to deposit and something to withdraw, and you have to work with your actors to be able to see those cues online and to modulate their acting accordingly. And this is just one of the lessons that we learned, but I find it to be maybe the most interesting. So there's this whole set of techniques that aren't a part of, you know, acting for the camera in terms of movies or TV or commercials or whatever, and also are not part of acting for the stage. They are specific and germane to acting for the compressed data stream.
Yeah, that's what my next question was going to be about, marrying the two, but you actually have to almost dispense with it. It's a whole third different thing, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, to be sure, there's a Venn diagram here, right? Yeah. Where when you're acting for the data stream, it's going to participate in techniques that benefit the camera and techniques that benefit the stage. But there are a few things that are discrete from both. And so it is a third thing with heavy overlaps into those two that are individuated themselves. And, you know, we had a bang up group of actors, and we were really alert to the fact that we were then doing something brand new. At that point, no one had done this. There had been, and I say that with great caution. It's very easy, especially in the tech world, to tout that you're the first. Man, I did my research on this question, and there were an awful lot of things that came before us that mimicked what we were doing, that aped it. And it was interesting. There was like a catalog of 10 that people would be like, no, you're not the first. There's X. And X I'd heard 8 different times. And I knew exactly what X did. And it wasn't what we were doing. But it was a successful mimicry of it. And so the result was that we were excited. And the actors really took on these new techniques with gusto. And Beth and the acting team were really patient with, I'm sure, my terribly boring explanations of why my theory was in place and why I thought it might work, right? But it was all a bunch of hypotheses that we just tested, and some of them were wrong and some of them were right. And it was a very exciting time, and the actors really worked hard to modulate their technique.
My question – well, you can continue with what you were going to say before I interrupted you in terms of the project that you were working on in this project too. But it is interesting, though, in terms of acting, of exploring this completely new territory. You have a main foundation, of course, but, you know, what can happen – I mean, it's just, it's exciting.
Yeah, it was thrilling. One of the interesting things that happened that was really unexpected was we would leave the cameras on after, and we invited people to just stick around and have conversations with their remote audience counterparts. And of course, those were being streamed as well. So some of the most interesting theater were spontaneous first-time conversations between strangers that had just had a shared experience. And then in addition to that, there was a number of situations where friends who lived in London and Austin, who knew each other from however their lives led them to know each other, scheduled their theatrical attendance so that they could attend the same play. And they would then sit down at the seat and have basically a public video phone call with each other to catch up. And that was quite an interesting event. And it really underscores this, one, that it's more efficient to move ones and zeros than our meatware. And two, the kind of extraordinary flatness of the world in terms of social interconnectivity. And so it was, I don't know, it was a very interesting moment of colliding interactions that we were starting to take for granted, that were global and real time and interactive in an extraordinary way, and then just mapping that onto an artistic experience with enough subtlety to help the technology disappear as much as it could.
How was that generally received initially?
Yeah, well, I mean, we got a lot of press, so that was exciting, and press is good. It played at the Roundhouse in London, and they had pretty good audiences. In Austin, we were in a site-specific venue, and we sold out virtually every performance. However, I should point out that that isn't all that much of an accomplishment because our site-specific venue was very small. I mean, it was 35, 40 people. So the numbers on our side were quite low. The numbers in London were pretty substantial. It was in the Roundhouse, which the main venue in the Roundhouse is, you know, enormous. But it was a lesser venue inside the Roundhouse, maybe 100 people or so a performance. But at least, you know, close to as interesting. I think we ended up 2.5 times our online audience, or rather our online audience was roughly 2.5 times our physical audience. And so it definitely threw it out to an online audience fairly substantially. And those numbers would grow in subsequent projects as people started looking to us more for online theatrical experiences. I would say the biggest success was critical, and the audience success was solid, but nothing to kind of go crazy about.
Well, it's completely new for them too, so yeah. You know, you're always wary of stuff like that a little bit at first, and then maybe you loosen up after a while. But if it can continue, you know, that's one of the things that I like to do. Purpose of this program is I like to get Baltimore involved. To have a partnership, well, it is already involved with Philip Arnault, who we'll talk about in a little bit.
Good.
But I wanted to pursue this on a continuous basis, have a network.
Yeah, I mean, I am really appreciating what Arnault, and I know we'll talk more about him in a bit, and here you are bringing in terms of connecting the artistic community. And I feel like, you know, the more we can extend that into how we create the art itself, the more virtues we'll get, you know, which is not to say that a digital connection obviates a physical in-person connection. And yet there's an awful lot that can be gleaned from it. I mean, I feel like we never would have thought a decade ago that there would have been so many authentic relationships emerging from people who knew each other only online. And there's a way in which, as the technology becomes more and more life-size, it's going to do a more and more effective job of communicating successfully what is subtle and essential about our connections that we always get when we're in physical connection. And so while I don't think it's ever going to end up being an absolute replacement, I think that it's headed in a direction that it will become a more and more effective replacement. And I know that scares a lot of people, but for me, it's a good thing. It just means the capacity for more authentic connection. To say it's a bad thing is to assume that it will be an inferior connection. And I think that that is a dubious proposition and kind of an anti-Luddite position. And in the theater, which is natively anti-Luddite, I would say a dangerous proposition.
You're going to get theater purists that say this is destroying it. But, I mean, their take on it and our take still, it's in the infancy stages, is that we don't really know exactly where it's going to evolve to. We think it's going to really improve things. I know one thing, and that is internationally, I think it will really, for lack of a better word, improvement, but really a connectivity on an ongoing basis. I mean, this can be archived so people can listen and watch at any given time, right?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, we're talking about that we're still in on the ground floor here. We get networking and get opinions and help from people all over the world and see how it evolves.
You know, that's right. And one of the things that you just mentioned evokes for me is this, you know, I referenced the Venn diagram of it earlier. I feel like digital interactive theater, which is the term I use to refer to this kind of subdiscipline, is an effort to partake of the virtues of scalability and distributability that we get from camera work and the viscerality, immediacy, and interactivity that we get from onstage work, and to inherit both of those and to see what new things emerge from it. And if you can have a theatrical moment that successfully scales to a broader audience that has to be good for theater. You know, there's no way that's not a good thing for theater. And there will always be the naysayers. I also feel like those naysayers need to be at the table because their concerns reflect accurate concerns about how you could fail it or come short on the goal. And so it's always my, when I have these conversations with folks who have a kind of Luddite sensibility about theater, which is frankly most theater makers, I really encourage them to recognize that that's why they need to be doing it, because the considerations that they have will be absent unless they bring them to the table. And their considerations about, you know, making sure that the human spirit is part of it, that we don't lose something that can't translate into zeros and ones. Well, those are real. Those shouldn't be overlooked, but they will get overlooked if those folks don't come to the table.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why I was asking questions about the actor's take on it, because that has to be the main focus no matter what happens. If we got to let it all become robotic or what have you, for lack of a better word, then it defeats our purpose. But
yeah,
it's
well
interesting.
Said.
When I was talking about the purists, I was thinking most of the audience, but yeah, there will be theater practitioners. And the thing is that it's almost like a prejudice because they have no frame of reference on how it's going to be, on how it's going to really affect work. Theater's got to always be evolving too.
Yeah, absolutely. To stay vital, it's got to keep up. It's got to keep working and keep developing. I agree completely. And, you know, it's a perennial conversation about whether the theater is dead. And you know, clearly it's not. And yet, if it were to just dig its feet into the ground, I think it would. And I'm a committed classicist. You know, I actually spend as much time working on Shakespeare as I do on digital work. So, I'm a great believer in holding on to the select treasures from the past. But of course, in that work, we better keep that work alive and vital too. And wouldn't it be nice if it can map on to new technology as well?
That's right, exactly. And there's always, you know, the chance that it will or maybe not. Getting very excited about all this. So where were we before we went off on this tangent? We were talking about the project. And is there anything else you want to add to the project with London and Austin?
I mean, I'm happy to answer any questions about it. I'm also happy to talk about, I guess, one of the subsequent projects that came up.
Well, that's right.
And how that played out. And,
sure, go
and
ahead.
Then maybe leave the question and go on to the next. So Beth, with a writing partner, wrote a play called The Girl with Time in Her Eyes that we presented at the top of 2013. And it was a piece that continued this thread in ways, but it was a very new thread in many ways. In this piece, it was, you know, one of the buzzwords out there is transmedia. So it was a transmedia piece insofar as it was happening across multiple media before, during, and after the performance. And there's a lot of great work going out there in the world in this regard. Too many, really, I think, to conveniently cite. But there's a lot of good stuff. Our innovation, at least I think this one is an innovation. I'm a little more cautious about saying we're the first one to do this because I haven't been as thorough in my research. But we integrated into the narrative a methodology of, well, printing and then projecting QR codes during the course of the play itself that would reveal new information about the narrative and what was going on stage. And so the narrative was structured to basically say, this just in, right? And so when this just came in, it came in the shape of QR codes. Those QR codes then led to a really bewildering array of pieces of mysterious content out there on the web.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt you here, but sometimes you get a little bit too technical here. So what is a QR code?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. A QR code is a printed image that you can link web data to. And so you will see them a lot around. They're usually a black and white square, and they look very cubic.
Oh, okay. I know what you mean. All right. Yeah, you can stick your phone on it and stuff.
That's exactly right. So you can stick your phone on it and read whatever is embedded within that code. And how things are embedded in that code is that it points to some sort of digital activity. And so what we did is pre-build the QR codes and have them kind of built into the narrative so that they would come in at the right moments. And we linked them to things like web assets that would tell different parts of the story. We created different kinds of, you know, apparently real looking websites that backed up this part of this character's narrative. We also had it do things like drop a contact number onto your phone that if you called had an outgoing message from one of the characters and you could leave a message for them and that would get you a response by SMS. Similarly, we would trigger an SMS message to someone or an inbound message with content putatively from one of the characters. And so there was this, it basically was a mystery play and you had to solve the mystery, the audience did. And in order to do so, they had to use their smartphones to glean data that we were presenting to them in an emerging way in the course of the narrative. And one of the most interesting things that came out of that was that we intentionally overwhelmed the audience. There was more data coming at them than any one person could get. And that had the spontaneous result of the audience actually teamworking. They spontaneously said, okay, you get that projection, I'll get this projection, you get that sheet, I'll get it, and we'll share the information. And so there was this interesting kind of game where the audience teamed up to glean all the information we were presenting.
It's fascinating, and it also gets a new audience in there too. Ones that wouldn't necessarily participate off a stage in an audience in a theater, too. You know, people. That
yeah, absolutely. And this was actually performed at this year's South by Southwest festival, and so it could conveniently sidestep the immediate issue that such an effort presents, which is the digital divide. I mean, certainly, if we want to be socially responsible, what we don't want to do is make it such that in order to experience the art, you better be of such a socioeconomic status that you can afford a smartphone, right? I mean, there's clearly ethical quandaries bounded in there. However, if you're at South by Southwest Interactive, you've already precluded everyone who's on the other side of the digital divide. So we could sidestep that issue there. I'm kind of interested in how you embrace, how you accommodate, really, is the right way of saying it, the digital divide in a context where your set of the desired audience is the public rather than a subset which will necessarily have a smartphone.
I'm talking with Robert Matney, and we're talking about integrating technology in live, legitimate theater. And we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back.